Hello, fellow foodies. I don't know about the weather in your part of the world, but it has been a hot, hot, hot muggy summer in Georgia. Despite the heat, summertime is definitely one of my favorite seasons for checking out some tasty crops. This episode was inspired by some delightful encounters I had with some deep, red, juicy, vine-ripened fruits. Some may call them tomatoes, others call them tomatoes, but no matter which pronunciation that you prefer, I think most can agree that there is just something special about a vine-ripened tomato, whether eaten on its own, in a salad, over pasta or rice, or in a variety of sauces. Today, tomatoes are treated in fresh form or processed and sold in soups, as paste, sauce, juice, concentrate, or in sun-dried form and in ketchup. Worldwide production of tomatoes has reached a whopping 177 million tons in the year of 2016, and it is the seventh most important crop in cultivation today. Today, China actually produces 56 tons of tomatoes every year, and that's nearly one-third of all tomatoes commercially cultivated on Earth. If you look back at tomatoes' origins, though, you might be surprised to see its links with poisonous plants in the deadly nightshade family. Selective breeding has also led to an astonishing array of tomato varieties that come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. Besides its tasty role in the kitchen, this crop has also been linked to a number of health benefits, ranging from antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and anti-cancer activities. On the other hand, for some people, the tomato or even tomato products can also exhibit some harmful effects, ranging from heartburn, allergies, irritable bowel syndrome exacerbation, and urinary problems. Well, why and how does it actually do that? This fruit has quite a few secrets to share, so let's dig in and learn more. The scientific name of the tomato is Solanum lycopersicum, and it is a member of the Solanaceae family. Other close relatives in the same genus include potatoes and eggplants, also known as aubergines. As a genus, Solanum is quite large and diverse, containing somewhere between 13 and 1700 species. Botanically speaking, the fruit of this species is actually a berry, though in cuisine it is often considered a vegetable due to its use in savory flavored dishes. Wild tomatoes originated in the western part of South America, along the coast and into the Andes and even the Galapagos Islands. The geographic diversity of the Andes fostered diversity of species across the Solanum genus. The center of domestication for the tomato is a point of contention among botanists, with two hypotheses prevailing, the Peruvian and the Mexican hypotheses. A combination of archaeology, history, botany, genetics, and archaeobotany will be required to solve this question. Scholars believe that tomatoes were imported to Europe in the 16th century. And just think about that for a moment. Before then, there was no tomato sauce in Roman or Italian cuisine. So what did they eat? We'll save that for another episode. It is thought that the most likely route of the tomato to Europe was by the Spanish conquistador Cortes, who introduced a small yellow-colored tomato to Spain following the capture of the great Aztec city of Tenochtitlan, known today as Mexico City. From Spain, the tomato likely reached Italy via the port of Napoli, or Naples, which was a Spanish-controlled territory at that time. The famous Italian botanist Pietro Mattioli, who is best known for his work in updating Dioscorides' seminal work, De Materia Medica, also examined the tomato, and a record of this can be found in an herbarium collection of Mattioli's that was written in 1544. The tomato likely entered European cuisine not long after its introduction, as records of its use in gazpacho recipes have been found and dated to the 1600s. From the Mediterranean, the tomato then spread by trade to other parts of Europe and abroad as far as Asia. By the 1800s, numerous cultivars of this unique fruit had emerged, resulting in the production of a variety of fruits of various shapes, sizes, sweetness, and colors for consumption. The point of domestication is not the only aspect of the tomato that has been debated by scientists. There has also been a lot of contention over its very name. Carl Linnaeus, the Swedish botanist and inventor of the binomial system of nomenclature, originally classified the tomato plant under the name of Solanum lycopersicum in the year of 1753. However, shortly thereafter, in 1768, an English botanist by the name of Philip Meyer moved the tomato to its own genus and named it Lycopersicon esculentum. This technically broke the priority rules of the Linnaean naming system, but regardless, it remained the scientific name for the tomato for centuries. Now, new genetic evidence shows that Linnaeus had actually been correct all along in his placement of the tomato in the genus Solanum, and Solanum lycopersicum is now the accepted scientific name, though both names will likely appear in the scientific literature for years to come. One of my favorite field research sites is located on a little island chain off the west coast of Sicily, near the city of Trapani. There are five islands that pop out of the glistening Mediterranean Sea there, and three of these are inhabited. In Italian, these are known as the Isole Egadi. In English, they're known as the Aeganian Islands. For you history buffs out there, the last Battle of Carthage was actually fought in the waters around these islands in 241 BC, ending the First Punic War with the Romans. I wasn't there on a hunt for war relics, though, but rather for wild plants that are used in food and medicine by the locals. Joining me on this trip were my husband, Marco, our three kids, a grad student, and two Sicilian collaborators who really knew how to cook some amazing local dishes, many of which featured, you guessed it, tomatoes. Hands down, though, my favorite dish was pasta con il pesto trapanese, or simply pasta trapanese, which translates to pasta with Trapani-style pesto. Now, I've never been a huge fan of basil and pine nut pesto, but there was something about this that was totally different and absolutely delicious. I actually tried to make this dish over the past weekend, and it reminded me just how much I loved it, as did my kids. They all went in for two extra bowls of the pasta. Okay, so I'm going to share the recipe with you, and here are the ingredients that you'll need to make the dish. This is enough for 2 to 3 adults. For my family of 5, we usually double the recipe if this is our main dish of the meal. You'll need 500 grams of spaghetti pasta, and this is usually the size of one pack of pasta. You'll also need 500 grams of vine-ripened, very ripe tomatoes. You'll take 10 leaves of fresh basil, a clove or two of garlic, although it depends on your preference. Some actually prepare it without the garlic. You'll also need 100 grams of grated pecorino cheese, or you could also substitute this with grated Parmesan if you can't find pecorino. And pecorino, by the way, is a kind of hard sheep's cheese. Okay, you'll also need 30 grams of raw, not roasted, almonds. You can buy these whole or already cut up into chunks. Then you'll need extra virgin olive oil, some salt, and pepper. The great thing about this recipe is that it uses all fresh ingredients and is super fast to pull together. The only thing that you'll be cooking is actually the pasta. So to begin, put a pot of water on the stove to boil, and once it begins boiling, you're going to add a small handful of rock salt or kosher salt to it. And in the meantime, take out your basil leaves, your fresh clove of garlic, your almonds, and a tablespoon or two of oil, and put all of that into a mortar and pestle and just grind them up nice and fine. You can also do this step in a pulse mode in a food processor if you don't have a mortar and pestle. However, I highly recommend a mortar and pestle. There's a lot of cool stuff you can do with spices using that. Okay, next you're going to transfer this to a large bowl and mix in your pecorino cheese and some more olive oil, a couple of tablespoons at least. And really, you can adjust this to taste once you add in the pasta. And then you're going to add a few grinds of whole black pepper. In the traditional recipe, the tomato peels are actually removed prior to the de-seeding of the tomatoes and chopping them into cubes. You can do this by blanching and peeling the tomatoes by hand, but honestly, I like the fresh chopped tomatoes with their skin just as well, and it's a lot quicker to do. The important step is to remove the seeds and liquid from the tomatoes so that you don't create a very liquidy sauce. So once you've taken your chopped tomatoes, you're going to mix those in with the pesto bowl and cook your pasta until it's al dente. Drain it and then toss it into this large bowl with the pesto. After serving in bowls, you can then top it off with a fresh basil leaf and some more pecorino. And enjoy. You'll find that the almonds add a delightful crunch to this Sicilian twist on pesto. So, buon appetito. Ripe tomatoes are rich in phenolic compounds and carotenoids, which are the primary biologically active compounds that have been identified in the fruits. They are also a rich source of ascorbic acid, also known as vitamin C. That deep red color that we note in tomato fruits is due to the presence of high levels of the carotenoid compound known as lycopene. We'll cover a bit more on the health benefits of lycopene and other carotenoids found in tomatoes, like beta-carotene, in a bit. Tomatine, on the other hand, is a defense compound made by the plant that is present in its stems, leaves, and unripe fruits. It is a mildly toxic glycoalkaloid, and if consumed in high levels, especially by eating the leaves of tomatoes, acute tomatine toxicity can occur, and this is characterized by vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, drowsiness, confusion, weakness, and depression. These acute toxicity symptoms are very similar to those seen in solanine poisoning. Solanine is a glycoalkaloid that is found in potato leaves. Remember, potatoes are also a member of the Solanaceae, or deadly nightshade family. The lesson here is avoid eating leaves of tomatoes or potatoes. Now, for people that have allergies to tomatoes, the symptoms typically occur right after consuming the food, and these can range from symptoms of sneezing, skin problems like eczema and rashes, and swelling of the mouth or face. Various scientific studies have isolated different allergens from tomatoes, and this includes a tomato protein that can cause intense histamine release. For people that suffer from kidney disease, tomatoes may need to be avoided in the diet due to the high levels of potassium found in tomatoes, as well as compounds known as oxalates, which can lead to kidney stone formation. For patients that have gastrointestinal disorders like heartburn and irritable bowel syndrome, tomatoes may also need to be avoided due to their acidic nature and due to the potential for allergenic reactions that can cause gut irritation, especially in patients with irritable bowel syndrome. Overall, in the absence of allergies and any other underlying gastrointestinal or urinary tract conditions, tomatoes are a well-tolerated and healthy botanical ingredient to include in the diet. Okay, let's get back to those health-benefiting carotenoids. As I mentioned before, the predominant health-boosting carotenoid found in tomatoes is a compound known as lycopene. Studies on lycopene levels in tomatoes and tomato products have shown that the highest levels of lycopene are seen in tomato paste at 55 milligrams per 100 grams of paste, tomato sauce at 18 milligrams per 100 grams of sauce, tomato juice at 11 milligrams of lycopene per 100 grams of juice, and raw tomato at 9 milligrams of lycopene per 100 grams of fruit. Now, these levels can also obviously vary depending on the cultivar of tomato being assessed and the level of maturity of the fruit at the time of harvest. You might think at this point that eating tomato paste is the way to go. Well, not so fast. The key here is not only which tomato product has the most lycopene, but rather the way that the final food is actually prepared. It can have a huge influence on the final pharmacology of what you're eating. It turns out that lycopene, the carotenoid red pigment with health benefits, is actually water insoluble. This impacts the way that your body takes up this compound and distributes it to various organs. This is where food pharmacology really shines. First, we know that heating tomatoes transforms all translycopene or all E isomers into cislycopene or all Z isomers, which are better absorbed in the body due to their enhanced solubility in bile acid micelles in the gut. The Z isomers also exhibit better antioxidant activity than the E isomer. One study showed that cooking tomatoes with onions also enhances this transformation from E to Z isomers. Now, that's not all. Is anyone in the audience a fan of the Mediterranean diet? If you are, then you likely use a hefty dose of extra virgin olive oil when making your tomato sauce. There's a pharmacological benefit in that too. Recall, lycopene is water insoluble, but it is lipid soluble or fat soluble. And studies have shown that tomatoes cooked with olive oil result in higher plasma lycopene levels in the body. In other words, cooking the tomatoes in a healthy fat aids the absorption of this health-benefiting molecule once it reaches the gut. Indeed, a study in which volunteers consumed tomatoes cooked in olive oil compared to those cooked and consumed without olive oil found significantly greater levels of the Z isomers of lycopene in their blood plasma. I've mentioned before on the show that my husband is from Italy, and I've spent a good deal of time there between field research on wild plants found in the countryside and also visits with my family and his family in the Basilicata province, just a few hours inland from Naples. I owe so many of my cooking skills to the patient teachings of my mother-in-law, Milagros. She actually grew up in Spain, but has lived in southern Italy for more than 50 years after marrying my father-in-law. As a result, she has a strong grasp on the Mediterranean diet from both the perspective of a Spaniard and an Italian. She always makes her tomato sauces from scratch and often even makes her pasta at home. Every year, she and her daughters get together to process kilos of fresh tomatoes that my father-in-law has grown in their family garden. The tomatoes are blanched to remove the skin. Some are boiled into a sauce and bottled with a leaf of basil, while others are bottled whole. These then serve to make dishes throughout the year. When it comes to making the actual sauce for the meal, she takes a bottle of tomato sauce along with a few other key ingredients. The foundation to many of her sauces begins with extra virgin olive oil. The olives, by the way, are also harvested from their family orchard and pressed at a local mill. Then she grates a bit of garlic, carrot, celery, and onion together, and these are cooked in the olive oil until softened. The jar of tomato sauce is then added in for continued cooking, and lastly, it's seasoned with a bit of salt and sometimes aromatic herbs, like the dried flowers of wild oregano that are collected every summer. This simple combination of fresh vegetables not only yields an amazing flavor profile, but think for a moment on the health benefits. Number one, the tomatoes are already reduced into a sauce with heating, which releases much of the lycopene from the plant cells. Number two, the tomatoes are cooked with two allium ingredients, onion and garlic, to enhance that transformation of E to Z isomers of lycopene. Carrots, which also contain a number of health-benefiting carotenoids, are also at play here. And then three, the olive oil ensures that the transformed lycopene will actually reach optimal pathways to absorption from the gut, ensuring that you get the best benefits from the lycopene and that it's not just passing through the gut to be pooped out. There is science going on in my mother-in-law's kitchen, and she's not only cooking a meal, she's also cooking up a health food for her entire family to eat. Why is lycopene such a great antioxidant, even up to 10 times better than vitamin E? Well, it all comes down to its chemical structure. Lycopene has a long chain structure with dienes. For the non-chemist in the audience, a diene is a compound with two double bonds, usually between carbon atoms. The number of conjugated double bonds in the chemical structure of lycopene makes it a potent singlet oxygen quencher. In other words, a fantastic antioxidant. Now that we have a grasp on the mechanisms by which lycopene gets into the body, let's cover some of the clinical studies on health benefits observed. First, I'd like to explore the effectiveness of tomatoes against cardiovascular disease and metabolic syndrome, in other words, heart health and obesity. There have been many clinical trials with cardiac, obese, and diabetic patients on tomatoes in the diet. While it is beyond the scope of the podcast to go into each of these in detail, there are some general trends that have been observed in multiple studies. Many studies have observed a decline in serum triglycerides, plasma total cholesterol, and in multiple markers of inflammation in the body, including C-reactive protein, IL-6, IL-8, and TNF-alpha. Improvements in blood pressure and lower cardiac risks have also been observed. Overall, consumption of tomatoes or their products, including things like paste, sauce, and juice, have all demonstrated positive effects on biomarkers related to diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease in numerous clinical trials. Moreover, tomato consumption in these trials resulted in very few or no adverse effects, with tomatoes being considered a safe and well-tolerated dietary ingredient. So what have we learned about this special berry? Well, it has a complex origin story, lots of interesting health benefits, and the way it is prepared can really impact its pharmacological value in the diet. So whether you like your tomatoes fresh or processed, in a sauce or chunky salsa, now you know that adding a few companion ingredients like olive oil and onions, as well as heating them, can give your final dish an extra antioxidant boost. Today, tomatoes are cultivated across the globe. To accommodate the rigors of transportation, they are often harvested while green and then ripened using ethylene gas, which helps the fruits to change in color. Note that production of ethylene is a natural process also used by the plant for vine ripening as well. If you have the opportunity, though, to grow your own tomatoes in a home garden or even in a container in a sunny window or on a porch, I really encourage you to do so. There is a huge difference in flavor when you have the opportunity to eat tomatoes in their vine-ripened state. Also, I want to give you some extra helpful tips on how to store tomatoes once they're harvested, either at home or if they're purchased in the store. Number one is that it's best to store them outside of direct sunlight and at room temperature. Refrigerating whole tomatoes will impact their final flavor and texture, so avoid the temptation to throw them in the fridge. If they're not fully ripe yet when you purchase them or harvest them, you can store them in a paper bag to capture more of the natural ethylene gas that they produce in the ripening process. If you're growing them on your own, remember that tomatoes are also super easy to process and store back for use throughout the year. You can do as my mother-in-law does with home canning. They are acidic enough to can using a simple hot water bath, but you can certainly also use a pressure cooker to can if desired. Sun-dried tomatoes also store well under olive oil for use as a healthy snack. Next time on Foodie Pharmacology, I'm going to speak with award-winning author, Professor Victoria Johnson. Victoria is a historian and wrote a fascinating book on the life story of Dr. David Hossack, who was a botanist and physician that was a contemporary of Thomas Jefferson and the personal physician to Alexander Hamilton. Hossack simply loved botany, and following his medical and botanical training in Europe in the 1700s, he returned to America and established the first botanical garden in the United States in 1801. Victoria and I will chat about her book and discuss the plants that Hossack included in his own garden of American Eden. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the podcast for the food curious, recorded in Atlanta, Georgia at the Emory University Center for Digital Scholarship. You can subscribe to the podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes. Spread the word. Tell your friends. If you've got a great idea for a future show or even a tasty recipe you'd like me to share, reach out to me. You can find me on our Foodie Pharmacology Facebook page or Twitter and Instagram at Quave Ethnobot, spelled Quaveethnobot. I'll see you next time. Hey, Foodie Pharmacology fans, this is Cassandra Quave, and I wanted to give a shout out to my buddy Taylor Sparks, who is co-host of the Materialism podcast. So Taylor and I actually met in Kuwait City, I don't know, maybe a year or so ago, and he does some super cool work on material sciences. And one of his recent episodes was actually on the science behind chocolate and how the tempering process works and how to make really the best chocolate from a physics and materials perspective. It was really fascinating. So I want to let you know about his podcast. Again, it's Materialism. It's available on iTunes, and I hope you enjoy. Thanks.